We've arrived at the last formal service for the year 2006, and it's our privilege to hear Brother Michael Nicora, and his subject is the seven deadly sins. The seven deadly sins. Brother Michael.
Everybody likes numbered lists. The ancient travel agents didn't just have their wonders of the world. They had seven wonders of the world. Tim doesn't just have steps to get a lively hope. He's got five steps. God gives his commandments. He didn't number them, but we sure do. Everybody talks about the Ten Commandments. But when you read about it in the scriptures, they're not numbered. But we like it when we number our lists. Paul listed the fruits of the Spirit in Galatians. He didn't number them, but there were nine. Peter put eight on his list. Some were the same as Paul's, some were different. What about sins? Suppose that we started to list sins. How many would you have? Well, where would you stop? In fact, there is a list of sins in the Bible. It's in Proverbs chapter 6, verses 16 to 19, and I'm going to read it to you from the Knox translation, and none of you have that translation down there. But I like the way Knox rendered the Hebrew. He says, six things I'm going to tell you. I'm going to name a seventh for good measure. The Lord hates, will never abide. The haughty look. The lying tongue. The hands that take innocent life. The heart that ever devises thoughts of mischief. The feet that hasten upon an ill errand. The false witness whose every breath is perjury. And the sower of strife among brethren. These are pretty serious. We are talking about lying and murder, evil scheming, perjury, destroying relationships. These are all sins, but they are sins of commission. There are also sins of omission. In James chapter 4, and verse 17, and this is from the New American Standard, they render the Greek this way. Therefore, to one who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is sin. Well, to learn that we have a serious fault is one thing. But to discover a deadly sin in ourselves, which we hate to see in others, is even worse. And Paul, in his letter to the Romans, picked the one commandment that he knew that everybody had violated and which therefore proved all were sinful and they could not keep the law. And that is found in Romans 7, verses 7 and 8. And this is the way Phillips renders the Greek. And Paul, writing there in this letter, says, I should never have had sin brought home to me but for the law. For example, I should never have felt guilty of the sin of coveting if I had not heard the law saying, thou shalt not covet. But the sin in me, finding in the commandment an opportunity to express itself, stimulated all my covetous desires. Covet is an old-fashioned word. It carries the thought of desire, and especially a secret longing for something to which one has no right. In that respect, it's much like envy. Now, even though people would generally believe that they're better than they really are, most of us would agree that we have secret desires for things that we have no right to have. So, is that the only sin that can be laid at our doorstep? Of course not. We have all seen people who claim to possess great spirituality still do very evil things. How can this be? Well, they simply ignore or they rationalize their behavior, and not one of us is immune. Look at Jeremiah 17, verse 9. We read there that the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? The phrase blind spot describes this ability to practice self-delusion. Now, the phenomenon was illustrated in a wonderful metaphor used by Jesus, one we find in Matthew chapter 7 and verse 3. And again, this is the way Phillips renders the Greek. And in this metaphor, Jesus says to his audience, "Why do you look at that speck of sawdust that's in your brother's eye and you fail to notice the plank that is in your own?" You know, friends rarely tell us the things we don't want to hear. I suppose that's what makes them our friends. Of course, even if they were to do so, we probably wouldn't believe them anyway. So that's why conversations with people who dislike us can sometimes be very revealing. Our enemies have no reason to shield us from our own failings, and so maybe that's one more reason to love our enemies. Seven deadly sins. A long, long, long time ago, a list of seven deadly sins began to be circulated. You may have heard of them. The list hasn't really changed. Gluttony, greed, envy, sloth, anger, lust, pride. Now, although these are not listed in any one place in the Bible, all are condemned from Genesis to Revelation. Now, the sins that were mentioned in Proverbs 6 that we started with describe active behavior that we engage in against others. These seven deadly sins describe sins that we commit against ourselves. And that is what is so surprising, because committing them does not make us happier. It makes us more miserable than we were before. Let's look at the first. Gluttony. Now, gluttony is defined as an excess in eating and drinking. Now, you would think, from the appearance of those who model clothes, that everyone would want to be thin. And yet, the world is experiencing an epidemic of obesity. The World Health Organization estimates that the number of adults who are overweight or obese has now passed the 1 billion mark. Now, why is that? Well, There was a theory that a friend suggested that resonates with me. You know, he said perhaps because historically speaking, mankind has always had to work hard for its food, never had enough. So historically, whenever the patriarch brought down an animal, everybody gorged themselves because you didn't know where the next kill was going to come from. And so that habit became ingrained within the personality. And today, with an abundance of food, and especially in this country, we don't know how to stop eating. You know, these old survival kinds of things that we don't need now, they're still, I mean, you know, if the food is still on the table, what can you do? Most of us don't require very much food. To waste it, either through overindulgence or a misplaced desire for food because it is rare or because it is expensive, or even withholding food from the needy so we can have more, they're all symptoms of gluttony. Amazingly, Jesus' critics accused him of committing this sin. It's in Luke, the 7th chapter, verses 33 and 34. And we read, John the Baptist came. He didn't eat bread, didn't drink wine, and your appraisal is he has a devil. Now, the Son of Man comes, eats, drinks, and your appraisal, behold, a gluttonous man and a wine bibber. But let's broaden our view. Broaden our view beyond food and drink. If you feel that you have a right to anything and everything because you can afford it, if you indulge every whim, if you have no idea what the word moderation or self-restraint mean, you are guilty of the sin of gluttony. Now, typically, those who suffer from this and from other deadly sins don't see it in themselves. Now, if you say this particular sin is no big deal, you have successfully justified your own behavior to make sure that your conscience no longer condemns you. Next is greed. Greed says, only want my fair share. But in fact, it wants far more than that. Greed is typically associated with an excessive love of money and power, and there can never be enough. Once we begin to indulge a tendency toward greed, it is never satisfied. Greed demands the credit and the praise for the work done by others. Greed wants more than one needs or can ever use. Worshipping money is modern day idolatry. And yet our society encourages it, not by saying you ought to worship money. No, our society encourages by saying financial success or it's the good life or economic security. And with these phrases, the worship of money becomes entrenched. Now, Jude verse 11 speaks of ungodly men who ran greedily after the reward of after the error of Balaam for reward. Now, Balaam, prophet, lives in a distant country, comfortable surroundings. Let's assume he's happy. He was probably famous because a heathen king goes to a great deal of trouble to try to convince him to make a long journey to come and curse Israel, the enemy of the king. Now, even though God tells him, don't go, don't do it, he goes anyway. Clearly blinded by his greed for the money that the king is offering him. And that decision cost him his life. Now, if he had been content with such things as he had, if he had stayed home, he would have lived. Greed, at its worst, can be seen in the legend of King Midas, who had just one wish, and that was the ability to turn anything that he touched into gold. Now, of course, he was thinking about money. His wish was granted, and soon the palace was an amazing place. Even its outer gates had turned to gold. But he couldn't eat. He reached for an apple, and it turned to gold. And to the king's horror, when he touched his daughter as she ran to him, she turned to gold. Everything of any value suddenly had no value at all. So do you want the Midas touch? Gold, in any form, should not matter to you. The next sin is envy. Envy is a resentment of advantages that are enjoyed by others, coupled with a desire to possess those same advantages. It is one sin that is completely under our own control. You know, it is so shameful a passion, we can never tell anyone that we have it. Carried to an extreme, it is a desire for our own good, even if it means depriving others of what they have. Job chapter 5, verse 2, the NIV, resentment kills a fool. Envy slays the simple. The Hebrew word rendered envy is Strong's 7068. It's a word that is also translated jealousy. Now, if you have the power, you may decide to do what needs to be done to satisfy your envy. David took Bathsheba. Ahab murdered Naboth and took his vineyard. Now, one of the first accounts of human interaction is the experience between Cain and Abel. Cain envied his brother, so he killed him. Saul envies David and tries to kill him. But Jonathan, his son, the one whose interests were really threatened by David, loves him. But what do you do if you don't have the power to satisfy your envy? Now, although you may claim to have no envy, others might think differently as they listen to you speak. I once heard jealousy described as drinking poison and then waiting for the other guy to die. Do you have feelings of envy? If you do, don't tell us how unworthy others are for the good fortune that they are experiencing, and how much better it would have been for you to have received those same favors. Unless you destroy those feelings, they will surely kill you. Next is sloth. That's an old-fashioned word. It's an aversion to work. Nobody uses the word sloth today. But you know what we call it? Laziness. That's our word for sloth today. You know, there is a mammal called a sloth. I have not knowingly ever seen one. But I suppose it got its name because it's very slow moving. And it just seemed like the right word to give it. I always think about Adam, who, when the animals were brought to him, he gave them the name, you know. And when the sloth came by, he certainly knew what to call that. You know, sloth works to deaden our spiritual senses. It makes it more and more difficult for us to respond to God. And eventually, one just drifts off into the sleep of complacency. Look at this wonderful verse in Proverbs chapter 24, verses 30 to 34. The wise man says, I went by the field of the slothful, and lo, it was all grown over with thorns, and nettles had covered the face thereof. And then I saw, and I received instruction, yet a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep, and so shall thy poverty come. Paul told the saints in Rome to love one another and to be not slothful in business. That's Romans 12:11, and the NIV suggests never be lacking in zeal. You know, sloth is a sin that makes itself at home among the Laodiceans. In Revelation 3, verses 15 and 16, the message to this church says, I know your works. You're neither cold nor hot. So because you are lukewarm, neither cold nor hot, I will spew thee out of my mouth. We have another example of sloth in the parable of the talents. It's in Matthew, the 25th chapter. You know it so well. But just cutting to the one with one talent in verse 24 of chapter 25 of Matthew. It says, then the man who had received one talent came and he said, Master, I knew you were a hard man. So I was afraid, and I went out. I hid your talent in the ground. See, here is what belongs to you. Sloth was a problem in the church at Thessalonica. Paul wrote to them in 2 Thessalonians 3, verses 10 and 11. And this is the translation of the New English Bible. And Paul writes to this church, and he says, during our stay with you, we laid down this rule. The man who will not work shall not eat. Now, we mention this because we hear that some of your number are idling their time away, minding everybody's business but their own. Judas is an example of sloth. He wanted only what he saw as what was in his own self-interest. He's not interested in activity for the master. Zeal is the opposite of sloth. Zeal is the energetic response of the heart to God's commands. Wasting time is like receiving the grace of God in vain. Laziness is condemned because others have to do the work that we should be doing. It's like the sin of gluttony because it's a sin of waste. Indulging the sin of sloth makes it clear that we cannot be trusted with more responsibility. Why? Because we're demonstrating that we are unfaithful in what has been given to us. More than just doing nothing, there is that old proverb, the devil finds work for idle hands. Shows why it is so important to be zealous in the work of the Lord. Next is anger. Anger is another of the sins that is of our own doing. It is one of the most common, it is one of the most powerful of the seven deadly sins. It serves no legitimate moral purpose, and once aroused, it easily gets out of control. Now, even though indulging in anger is never in our own self-interest, those who do it always think that their anger is justified. Anger overturns, anger destroys, it never builds up, it never preserves. Anger makes everybody unhappy. Anger has been described as a love of justice which gets perverted into revenge and spite. Impatience with the faults of others is associated with anger. Now, of course, we should be impatient with the faults of ourselves. But very few are. Kindness is the opposite of anger, and it uses a tender approach with patience, with compassion. The greater the self-control, the less tendency there is toward anger. An angry person is out of control and will likely do things he'll regret later. Now, we mentioned Cain's feelings of envy toward his brother Abel. And those feelings soon became obvious as God speaks to Cain and he asks, "Why are you angry?" But Cain thinks his anger is justified, and so when the two of them are together in the field, he kills his brother. Has that made his situation better? Well, of course not. His situation is worse, and that is usually the case when those with no self-control take action. Now, one who becomes angry usually tells himself how justified he is in having such feelings. Soon he thinks about how to get even, how to take revenge, how to make someone else really suffer. Brethren, although this is so common in the world, don't you do it. Romans 12, verse 19 from the NIV. If it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Do not take revenge, my friends, but leave room for God's wrath. And verse 21, do not be overcome by evil. Overcome evil with good. Next on the list is lust. The word means to have an intense or an obsessive desire for something. It usually, at least today, is used in a sexual context. And like those of the other sins, it's essentially voluntary and completely under our own control. The Bible tells us about it in lots of places. The men of Sodom who had lusted for the guests who came under Lot's roof. David's lust for Bathsheba. He already had several wives. Amnon's lust for his half-sister Tamar. That's in 2 Samuel 13. But that's not the only kind of lust. There's the lust for power. And it seems to me that the poster child for that one is Jezebel. Jezebel would do anything to get power, and then anything she has to do to keep it. Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 6, "Now, these things were our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted." Then in verse 11, "Now all of these things happened unto them for examples." The margin of my King James here now says types. These all happened to them as types. They are written for our admonition upon whom the ends of the world are come. Now one example of Israel lusting after evil things is recorded for us in Numbers, the 11th chapter, verses 4 to 6. And it's there that we read that this mixed multitude that had come out of Egypt, that was among them, fell a-lusting. And the children of Israel also wept again, and they said, "Who shall give us flesh to eat?" Oh, we remember the fish that we did eat in Egypt freely. And now that you mention it, you know, there were the cucumbers and there was the melons and the leeks and the onions. And of course, the garlic, lest we forget. But now our soul is dried away and there's just nothing at all. Well, of course, except for this manna. Wasn't it great when we were in Egypt compared to the way it is now? Nostalgia works its magic. And the people can't quite remember those evil taskmasters who worked their fingers to the bone from morning till night. It's just that wonderful diet that they had. Oh, that we might have that. Do we have nostalgia for that which is forbidden? Do we tire of the same old manna day after day? Ingratitude of any kind is so sad to see. But the Lord may permit you to indulge your ingratitude if you have your mind set on it. Who will give us flesh to eat? Well, the Lord did. The quails came, but after the quails came, the plague followed, and there we read that they buried the people who lusted. Lust is the self-destructive drive for pleasure that is way out of proportion to its worth, whether it's sex, power, image, or anything else that has gotten badly out of control. But self-control, self-mastery prevent pleasure from killing the soul by suffocating it. The last on the list is pride. Pride is the only deadly sin that made the list in Proverbs 6:16. And in that particular place, it isn't called pride, it's called the haughty look. Some translations render it uplifted eyes, but that's pride. Pride, sometimes called vanity, feeds all the other sins. Pride makes you think that you are the most important. Thus, you believe that gluttony or greed or lust are legitimate ways to satisfy your needs, no matter what it does to others. Now, if you think that you are important, well, then envy tells you that you deserve what others have. And important people, we all know, don't have to work. And since you are important, sloth is encouraged. And those who disagree with you, well, they deserve your anger. It has been said that temper gets us into trouble. And pride keeps us there. The irony is that indulging pride almost always makes one miserable. You don't think so? Okay, I want you to picture in your mind's eye somebody that you know who is focused only on himself, his needs, his wants, his rights, including, of course, plastic surgery, hair implants, Botox, whatever it is that is going to deliver the right image. You know, could be a her, I said himself, but you know, you must know someone, you know, in your mind like that. Okay, you got that, you know, in your mind? Is that person happy? I doubt it. Okay, race the chalkboard. Picture in your brain, in your mind, someone that you would say is happy. Doesn't matter whether it's in the fellowship or outside the fellowship or not. Just someone that, in your estimation, that person is happy. Okay, so you know, everybody's got, I'm sure, a different image in their mind. Why is that person happy? I mean, you know who it is because you've got it in your mind. But why is that person happy? The likelihood, I suggest, is that person is paying more attention to others than they are to themselves. When a person wants to be important or attractive to others, there is excessive self-love. And that's why pride is so hated by God. God should be the object of our love because of the grace that He has bestowed upon us. Excessive love for ourselves corrupts our relationship with God because it replaces God with another human being. And that human being is ourself. The seven deadly sins have also been called carnal sins. Carnal, of course, means the flesh. Paul equates carnality with death. In Romans 8, verses 6 and 7, he says, to be carnally minded is death. To be spiritually minded is life and peace. The carnal mind is enmity against God. Each of the seven deadly sins can be fought by seven key virtues. Moderation defeats gluttony. Generosity defeats greed. Contentment defeats envy. Zeal defeats sloth. Kindness defeats anger. Purity defeats lust. And humility defeats pride. Now, you don't have to memorize these seven antidotes to protect yourself from these seven sins. Take responsibility for your own behavior. Exercise more self-control. In Proverbs 16, verse 32, the wise man says, "He that is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he that ruleth his spirit," self-control, "is better than he that taketh a city." May the Lord give us the strength to bring every desire into subjection to His will, so that we may be found faithful even unto death. Amen.